Welcome everyone to today's Internet Seminar. My name is Jean Balint. I'm coming to you from EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division, where I'll be serving as one of the online moderators for today's session. Our seminar today has been sponsored by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers as part of their Military Munition Support Services online seminar series. Today's session will actually look at characterization as our primary topic. Our live technical broadcast will run from 1 p.m. Eastern to 4:45 p.m. Eastern. Before we begin the technical portions of our broadcast today, I'm going to cover some housekeeping and reminder items to make sure everyone is comfortable with how the session will run and is able to join us for our live broadcast. When you signed up for today's session, you would have been directed through both reminder messages and email confirmation screens, sending you to something called the seminar homepage. This homepage would have had a description of today's events, a complete agenda, contact information for the presenters, links to download copies of the PowerPoint material. But what I want to draw your attention to on that homepage is a button that says Go to Seminar. If you click that button, you'll be able to check yourself in and actually join us for the live interactive broadcast. If you have any problems joining us for that interactive broadcast, you can download copies of the PowerPoint presentations and simply follow along on the telephone. We do encourage you to try to join us online in the Adobe Connect broadcast room if possible. Our entire session today is going to be offered through a dynamic tool, Adobe Connect, where our participants will be able to both listen and watch the presenters in real time as they move through their materials from various locations. As I mentioned, you can download the materials if you want to take your own notes or have any problems with that online seminar interface. By default, audio is available online to every participant, so you can actually listen to this entire session through your computer or mobile device. If you have any problems with that online audio, the first thing you should do is check your local volume settings. Sometimes it's simply a matter of increasing your speaker output or going into the sound control settings and actually increasing the audio output. Some participants find that wearing a pair of headphones can help. If that still doesn't work, though, we do have toll-free telephone number and call-in information to share with anyone who needs it. You'll just simply need to request it using the Q&A window in the lower right corner, and we'll get you that call-in information right away. If you are joining us on the phones, though, all telephone lines will be kept on a listen-only mode, so you will only be able to ask questions by using the Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen. There's already a welcome message from me, Jean Balint, in that window. To submit your comments or questions, you'd simply type it into the thin white field at the bottom of the Q&A window in the lower right corner, and then either hit enter or press the little cartoon bubble to the right, and that will privately submit your comment or question. You can also, again, use it to report technical problems. If you need the call-in number, you can ask for it through the Q&A. Our moderators will then queue your questions up when we take designated breaks with our presenters and read the questions out loud for them to answer. You don't have to wait to designated breaks to submit your questions. You may do so at any time, and in fact, we encourage you to do them early. Feel free to test that Q&A window out, so if you want to see how it works, you can say hi, type in a status message, and just let us know how the audio and visuals are coming through. Today's session is being recorded and will automatically be shared with you via email in approximately 1 to 2 weeks. You'll be able to replay the entire broadcast, and if you're one of the participants listening to the recorded version right now, you'll actually be able to watch everything as it's dynamically happening through the recorded version, as well as interact with the live web links that you see on the right side of your screen. If you are interested in the previously hosted session that has been part of the Military Munition Support Services series that have been hosted here on the CLUIN website, you'll find those along with nearly 500 other archive sessions available for free replay on our CLUIN archive page. Again, the majority of your screen is going to be occupied by a PowerPoint slide presentation. As our speakers go through the materials, you can just watch as they click through. If you want to make those slides bigger or have any problems, there's going to be a full screen button that will appear in the upper right corner of that particular window. You can click it once to make the slides larger, and if you want to turn it off, just press full screen again. It'll shrink them back down. You'll see our sponsor logos and active hyperlinks over here on the right, and then just below that our all-important Q&A window where you can type up your comments, questions, and report technical problems at any time. And that's the end of the technical reminders that I have for today's broadcast. So I'm going to turn things over to one of my co-moderators, Dwayne Ford.
Very good. Thanks, Jane. Well, you know, I'd like to welcome everybody to the fifth little fireside chat in our Military Munition Support Services series. And since Jane's already reviewed the instructions and administrative announcements, we'll go ahead and get this high wire act underway. And first thing, you know, I'd like to thank everybody within reach of my voice. We're definitely indebted to EPA's CLUIN staff, especially Jean Balint, for their assistance and support in helping us conduct today's webinar. And we're grateful to all of you for making time in your schedules to join us today. You know, the theme for this month's webinar is characterization, and we have quite a few munitions projects that are in the characterization phase and quite a few more yet to come. One of the things that we've observed at the EMCX, and I'm sure it's not a surprise to anybody, is that the RIFSs, which are the most well thought out and well planned, you know, those are also the ones that are usually the most successful in actually characterizing the site. You know, where do we have a problem? Where do we not have a problem? And what does that problem look like? So you're going to see a common message in today's presentation. You know, like Yogi Berra's statement, good characterization is 90% mental, you know, the planning and preparation. And the other half is physical, the actual data collection. It shouldn't be the other way around. Now, we've got a number of terrific speakers today, and we've got a good variety of topics covering several of the tools on our characterization Swiss Army knife. So, you know, who knows? This session, it might get nominated for an Oscar. And then I'd also like to thank Nick Stolte. Nick's an engineer with the MCX, and he served as the offensive coordinator for today's webinar. So many thanks there to Coach Stolte. And I'm Dwayne Ford. I'll be facilitating the session today, trying to introduce the speakers and keeping us on time. Here's the agenda of what we're going to be covering today. And then, you know, most of the things here, Gene's already covered most of the bullets on here, but I would like to draw your attention to the very last bullet. So far, these M2S2 webinars have really enjoyed excellent attendance. And we hope that that means that our audience views the webinars as being a good value. And if that is indeed the case, please become a team booster and let your colleagues, your customers, regulators, friends, everybody within your network know about the webinars. So next month, the season finale, here's what we have coming up, a session on case studies and lessons learned. If you haven't already registered, get it in gear and do so. And once again, if you know someone who might be interested in the webinar, please let them know about the upcoming session. Now, you know, as Gene mentioned, the previous M2S2 webinars, those were also recorded, as today's is also being recorded, and they have been archived. So, you know, if you were off on vacation for an episode, hey, we've got a pseudo podcast waiting for you. And then, you know, this thing, you know, speakers and topics. We're putting out casting calls for next season. So if you think you could play a role on a future episode, please drop me a line. We have openings and would like to hear from industry, government, regulators, stakeholders, anybody. Please just let me know if you have an idea for a topic or a speaker. I'm sure that you haven't already forgotten about it, but here it is once more, the three R's of explosive safety. So please make sure that your project stakeholders hear and receive this message frequently. Now, our first speaker is Ryan Steigerwalt. And Ryan is he's the sitting president of the National Association of Ordnance Contractors. So Ryan's really the face of industry partnering with DoD to address the munitions contamination and hazards that's out there. And when Ryan's not acting all presidential and sitting in the NAOC Oval Office, he also happens to work for Weston Solutions. So Ryan, you have the podium.
Oh, great. Thanks. Well, thanks for the introduction. And Chris, Dwayne, and Nick, thanks very much for the invitation. It's always a pleasure to speak on behalf of NAOC. I guess the first thing I wanted to do is tell you a little bit about our association. NAOC is the Professional Trade Association for the Munitions Response Industry. Our members provide a full range of services from staffing to technology development to remediation, so kind of do it all. Over the last several years, you know, since we've been founded in 1995, we've really grown significantly up to about 77 members strong, both small and large businesses, as well as international firms. So it's been really great that to have this interaction and the depth strength that the association brings. So what we typically do is focus on four strategic objectives, and this is where we spend most of our time looking, obviously, to try to increase program funding levels, but certainly in today's environment, I think we would be happy with maintaining those levels. Everything we do is really to provide value to our membership, and we've been fortunate enough to collaborate with DOD over the years on the application of technology, guidance, and regulation, and most recently, we've been expanding our footprint, so to speak, to be recognized globally in the munitions response industry and also mine action. So none of this work would really get done unless it was for volunteers. It's all volunteer organization. Everything's kind of run in five committees, and those you'll see those on the right here, which is government affairs, operations and standards, technology, member services, and international affairs. So it always amazes me how much work these folks do. They have full-time day jobs, so this is kind of a second job for them. So it's really great. So here's a few of our broader initiatives, and I'd probably be remiss if I didn't mention our new logo design. We have a revamped website, so go ahead and visit us at NEOC.org. I mean, it's great. So everything's up there, our newsletters, all the information you need to contact us. So check us out. Let us know what you think. But first on the list here, as many of you probably know about, our Capitol Hill fly-in. This is where our members converge on the Hill and conduct those congressional visits. And we try to provide awareness about the military munitions response program, a little bit about safety aspects of unexploded ordnance. But we had a record year this year. 55 attendees came in from 35 member companies. We had 43 Hill visits scheduled, and then we got Snowquester. So DC shut down. I didn't know that could happen, but it did. That's my luck. But we'll be back next year and even stronger. So we also have a membership meeting every year. We have distinguished guest speakers come in to talk about technology transfer, program developments. This year it's in San Antonio, so check out the website, and there's links and information about that, and give me a call if you have any questions. One other thing our committees do is they're asked to review documents such as the new engineering manual 200-1-15, and most recently things like DDSB TP18. So that there's a great opportunity to get that feedback from our members and consolidated comments and reviews. So we also coordinate training events, for example, with ESTCP on geophysical classification courses. And our committees also participate in national events, like, for example, NEOC was just recently appointed to the International Mine Action Standards Review Board. Great opportunity for our members to provide input on mine action standards globally. So that's great news for us and the industry as well. But I think one of the most valuable initiatives, in my opinion, is our DoD partnering efforts. And that's the last bullet, and let me switch slides. And we've been holding that for the last 5 years or so, more formally than we have in the past, and really began with the Army Corps of Engineers and AEC coming together with us discussing PBA issues. But since then, we've really expanded that, and you can see the list of organizations there that now participate. And it's more of a broader discussion around topics related to really achieving DoD's cleanup goals. And I think this is one of the critical activities that we really do to share information and have candid and personal dialogue, you know, regarding munitions response program execution. So it's really been a great way to converse and discuss our partnering initiatives. Oops, let me switch here. In 2010, and this really ties into site characterization. NEOC drafted an industry perceived risk document that really listed concerns on PBA language and processes. You can see that this document was 18 pages. What you can't see is the first two pages were 8.5 by 11. The next 16 were 11 by 17. So this was a significant document, but really went through all those concerns and issues that we found with DOD, and it's been a collaborative effort over the last several years, and there's been, I think, positive changes to our PWSs and other bid documents. So it's really been a great process and really an accomplishment for everybody involved. So where are we now? Many of these things that I list in the next couple slides come from our recent partnering meetings as well as from our membership recently. I kind of reached out and pulled some folks on what they thought. So I probably have more questions than answers, unfortunately. So hopefully that will raise some dialogue here and there and maybe even on this phone call. But certainly we really appreciate the new streamlined OSD goals, I think, for achieving response complete. That really whittle it down to a shorter list. And so when you have a simple mind like I do, less is more. So I think that's great. But one question that keeps coming up with our membership is how many sites are really through the RI process or investigation process or nearly complete with the investigation phase of work. It's a little cumbersome to try to find that information, and I think in general that would kind of help with our internal planning. I mean, obviously we want the help to get to that response complete goal, but what's the interim goals or interim milestones that we're trying to get to, or where are we at with the program? Another thing that keeps coming up is certainly early notification opportunities is really helpful to prepare proposals, especially for complex RIs or complex munitions response sites that come out. I think a great example is the list of FUDS actions from 2012. I mean, that was a great way to just start some information gathering from our membership. I know there weren't any new starts this year, but things like that really help us, plan our year or plan our programs for our companies. Access to documents early in the proposal process is also important. Sometimes I've seen notes that sometimes we see PWSs released and documents for the sites or the installations come a little bit later. You know, it'd be great to kind of switch that around if possible, you know, just to get a jump on things. And, you know, some of the PWSs are obviously dated several weeks to a month prior. So if there's opportunity to just provide a little bit more notification before those come out, I think those are some of the comments our membership had for those instances. So the next thing is identifying site goals and objectives during the RFP process is certainly important, really to get people going in the same direction. It helps to be able to, I'm sure, evaluate things, apples to apples versus apples to oranges. So, you know, even things like anticipated land use or potential changes, I think all those things are helpful, you know, just to as part of the dialogue and as part of the process where it's possible. Where there might be uncertainty, you know, I think one thing that came out from our last partnering meeting is that our membership finds that unit pricing options are helpful to reduce risk to our group. So that's, I think that's being used here and there, and I think that's been a positive thing based on the feedback I've seen. One thing that we do miss our debriefs, certainly. We seem to have moved away from debriefs for actions less than about $5 million. Fortunately, a lot of our actions are less than $5 million, so we don't have a lot of debriefs anymore, but they're really important for lessons learned, both good and bad, I think, and for continual improvement really of the product we're providing. So getting that feedback is really important to us. As far as the project delivery side goes, one of the scariest things when trying to quantify risk is changed site conditions, especially under a performance-based contract. But we've been hearing that most groups feel that there's flexibility, so that you bought it, you own it type philosophy isn't as prevalent, I think, as we've seen in past years. So that's great progress. That certainly reduces risk for us and trying to get it through our risk review processes. So that's been great. And I think through these webinars and other events, like some of the NEOC meetings where we bring speakers in, the workforce is getting up to speed on technical aspects of the munitions response projects, in particular for RIs, where, you know, statistics come into play, incremental sampling, some of those things that maybe folks aren't typically used to. So I think there's been progress there, and we've certainly seen improvement and flexibility with approaches. So several members have pointed out that there's been seemingly variability in data needs between DoD organizations. One example was recently that I received an email is MC sampling. Is it no MEC, no MC, or do you need samples for an RI regardless? How about pre and post demolition, whether it's for an RI or for removal action? One question was, are there case studies or other sources of information that we can potentially reference to help guide the PDT in making the right decisions? So those are some of the questions that are out there. And of course, you know, we have to mention geophysical classification. It's a huge topic, and so far the transfer initiatives has been great. Just a couple weeks ago, however, I heard some questions on how and where can we apply it. Is it applicable for RIs? Are we past most of the RIs? And is it, you know, a remedial action technology? So, you know, it's interesting that those questions still remain in our community. And, you know, we're trying to figure out ways to communicate some of those things to our group and help them carry that along. And, you know, questions still are out there on contractor and analyst qualifications. So, there's a lot of things to talk about there still, and we're looking forward to those discussions. And the last thing on our list here is there are some concerns that some of the traditional DGM survey reporting seems to become more robust versus streamlined, and it may be increasing costs and decreasing production. And there's some concern of that maybe creeping into geophysical classification, making that even more difficult. So those are some of the other considerations our membership is talking about. So what are the next steps? Where do we go from here? So I think it's extremely important that we continue this dialogue, to find ways to meet and continually improve our processes. We want to work together, identify means and mechanisms for really personal interaction and professional development opportunities like conferences and workshops, despite the budget and travel constraints. You know, these webinars are great. Been getting a lot of great feedback, and I personally think they've been a good source of information, the complete work to see where we did good and what needs more work as we move past the investigation phase and start applying those lessons learned to future phases of work. We would certainly also like to help find ways to conduct debriefs if possible. It's really a benefit to, I think, both the government and the contractor, in particular for complex RIs. You know, I think like the Yogi Berra quote up front, I think that says it all. So getting some of that upfront feedback, I think that plays a huge part in project delivery. So let's see. I think the next slide is just really points of contact. Here are our officers, directors, and committee chairs. Go to the website for contact information. My email address is up there. So looking forward to any questions, and thanks very much again for the invite.
Excellent. Thank you, Ryan. Very much appreciate it. And we do have a few minutes left in Ryan's time slot. We've got one question that came in. I'll ask it in just a minute, but I did want to remind everyone that if a question comes to you, we will have a session at the end of the webinar for questions. So if you think of something for Ryan later on, then by all means, just submit it, and we'll get to it at the we'll get to it at the end of the webinar. But Ryan, we did have one question that came in, and it was, can you add anything more on initiatives between NAOC and DoD to get small business members qualified to use classification technologies?
Yeah, that's really a great question. I think that is one of the gaps we're facing right now. And we actually just had a board of directors meeting a couple weeks ago, and discussed some of those things more in regard to geophysical analyst qualifications and contractors. So, it appears like there's certainly a host of large businesses that are part of the ESTCP program for geophysical classification, but there's not really many small businesses out there that are participating. So, if somebody has ideas on how to help with that, I'm certainly all ears. We're struggling with that too, and it's something that we're tackling right now between our technology and standard and operations committee. So hopefully we have some better answers or a answer at some point in time that I can answer that. But I really appreciate the comment.
Okay, excellent. Does anyone else in the audience have a question for Ryan? We still have just a couple of minutes. We could probably field one or two more questions if they come in.
And this is Jean Balance. Remember, you can submit those comments and questions using the Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen. You simply need to type text into the bottom. There's a thin white box or field, and then hit enter or press the little cartoon bubble, and that'll privately submit it to our moderators.
I'm not th I haven't seen any other questions roll in here in just a minute, and since with this webinar format, people may be dialing in for specific presentations, so we're always reluctant to start a presentation early ahead of its scheduled time or after its scheduled time. We try to stick very closely to our agenda, and so it looks like we have just maybe one more minute before we're getting ready to get started with the next speaker. I do see possibly a question that came in here. Here we go, Ryan. Real quickly, do you think industry geophysicists would be willing to meet with Corps of Engineers geophysicists to discuss geophysics reporting issues?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely, and I think that's a great idea. I actually just got that comment right before I submitted the presentation, so I'll need to follow up to see what the details were and make sure we discuss that in detail. But that sounds like a great idea.
Okay. And one last question. Hopefully this will have a quick answer because we're getting ready to get started on the next one, next presentation. But so where can we get a copy of the 18-page document NAOC sent to DoD?
Well, that's on our website, and if you would like a copy, certainly you can contact me, and I'll get that to you.
Excellent. Very good. Well, we're getting ready to get started with our next presentation. So, Ryan, it was a pleasure. Thank you very, very much.
Thank
We
you.
are
Thank you.
grateful for it. And our next speaker is Mr. Bill Veith, and Bill is an Ordnance and Explosive Safety Specialist with the Environmental and Munitions Center of Expertise, the Corps of Engineers. And Bill has a wealth of knowledge about munitions and weapon systems. He started his career working on trebuchets, so he knows quite a bit about weapons throughout history. Bill's a go-to guy, but he also has a pretty keen eye for characterization. So he put together a few thoughts on RIFS, some of the key points, and what makes a good RIFS. So, Bill, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thank you, Dwayne. Can everybody hear me? Good afternoon. And these are considerations and things that we have run into as we have get documents in to review. When I talk about a site, I'm not going to name the site. That's not what this presentation is about. This is about the process and what we have found in the process as we have gone through. Okay. What we're going to talk about today is some goals of the RI, some contracting issues that affect characterization, and then data needs and quality. And then we're going to finish up with some institutional analysis during characterization. And we have this is one of the things that we have found that is not just doesn't get the importance that we feel it needs, and that is an institutional analysis, and when it's the fact it's done and when it just doesn't get the emphasis. In fact, we've proposed that we do a whole session on it, maybe during next year's sessions, if they're feeling that there's enough of a need. Okay, the next slide. We ask yourself, what's the goal of the RI? And to simplify that is determine where the problem is and where it is not. Okay? Also, we determine what that problem is, and that's determined as nature and extent. And when we first started this program years and years ago, we were not in the remedial process. We did almost everything in the ECA process. And that was not one of the goals of the ECA. The biggest goal of the ECA is to say, well, I have a problem. I need to address that problem. So we would go to a removal or the next phase. So what we're trying to do now is, and in that ECA, we didn't address the whole site problem. We may have taken care of the problem on site, but it was not the remedial. It was not the final action. So we really didn't go out there and try to prove that. And what's the consequences of that, of not doing that? The first one, if there's no risk or a hazard is identified or suspected, then we should go ahead and get unlimited use and unrestricted exposure on that site. In other words, I don't have a problem there. But what's the consequences? Over the years, they've been several, and they've resulted in doing unnecessary removal or remedial actions. And one that comes to mind is we had one site where we had evidence that in one corner of that site, there was a separate impact area. So we didn't feel that we needed any more field work to say, we've got a problem, we're going to have to do removals. So we didn't do any more field work in that area. And then later on, after we had promised to do removal, we found out we needed to do some field work out there to get an idea of what the problem was and how much it was. So we did some transects, and we identified anomalies on those transects. And then we went out and started digging those, and we found out that we did not have any MEC at all in that area, and yet we had promised to do the removals. And this caused a lot of problems with the local community because they were wondering why we were there anyway, because they had not had a problem. And there's been just several other cases of where we didn't do the characterization in certain sites. And the one in North Carolina, we had to go out and do a removal when the park decided they wanted to put a new headquarters and maintenance facility in. And we went out and we found virtually no problem there. So if we had done those characterizations, we would have been able to say we do not have a problem there. Another consequence is property owners may have restrictions on the land use of the property when, in fact, it's not contaminated. We had another site where a property owner decided that they wanted to change the land use, and it was going to be several years away before we could get in on that property. So it got to be a problem. But in this case, the district that was doing the work or proposed to do the work worked with the landowner and found out that they were in fact in the buffer zone and not in they had no actual targets on their property. But they still told him that go ahead and go ahead and do your land use change, and in the process, if you find something, let us know. We have a problem with more acreage when in fact we do not. Okay, so go to the next slide. And I put this in there to it sounds simple, and it was very simple when we started presenting this 10 years ago. That you go out and you run your transects, you find your areas of elevated anomaly counts, and then we put some mini grids in to determine what caused those elevated anomaly counts, and if its mutations are a problem, then we can we'll take care of it. And that sounds very simple to say, yeah, I have a problem in this part of my site up here, but it's not as easy as it looks. Now, this is a site and that was reported this way. This was after the field work. And you see up in here, the team didn't have rights of entry. So even though this area starts to go up in this part of the property, and then you're still not sure how far that goes. So the team, the project team, is got a dilemma here. They're not able to collect data in this portion, so they're not sure exactly what their problem is and where it is. And if you go over on this side, you can see the same problems. We have contamination here, we have contamination here, but we have a lot of areas where we were not able to get rights of entry, so we couldn't go out and collect data. Then you've got an area here that is got elevated anomaly counts. It turned out to be MEC related. Again, you've got on the southern portion, you've got a lot of areas where we couldn't get rights of entry. You've got a heavy contamination here on this edge of the edge and on this edge, but we're not sure because we can't get down in there. And every team is going to be faced with something like this. They're very similar. And that is, they're going to have problems with collecting data, with interpreting data, and then you've got the onus on the contractor. Where does this line go? Where do I actually have the problem, and where do I not have the problem? So it's very hard to draw that line. But that whole project team is going to have to determine how much data is needed, and if I can't get data, what I'm going to do. These are just some of the dilemmas you're going to run into. Okay, the next thing that you're going to may have some problems is contracting issues. And that is, the language can cause difficulties in execution. And one of the things is that would happen is we got in the habit of contracting the RI and the FS separately. And in one case, We contracted the RI at a site, and the goal of that RI was a fully characterized site, and that's exactly what they got. They got a fully characterized site. Good data. It was one of the best characterizations I had seen. Well, when they contracted the feasibility study, the FS, it just so happened the same contractor got was awarded the FS, and they went out. And that's when they really looked at who used the site and how it was used. And they found out there was absolutely no subsurface use of that site at all. It was not authorized, not allowed. And consequently, they had all this RI data. So when they developed their alternatives, it looked like they figured they needed to use all the data from the RI. And so even though we only had surface use of that property, we did not have an alternative that was for only surface, a surface clearance or a surface remedial action. So So that's one thing that happens. Another thing is optional tasks. If you put a lot of optional tasks, then the contractor who gets awarded that is really not sure whether they're going to do that task or not. And one of the things that I saw optional task early was the institutional analysis. And I don't know why that was, but it meant that we didn't do that institutional analysis early in the project. And we found out later since that we really need to do that. Okay. Okay, going to the next slide. Now we're going into the PWS, which is also contracting issues. But if the initial project delivery team meetings are held before the contract has been awarded, make sure all agreements are included in that performance work statement. And this happened when we did the work down at Pinecastle down in Orlando, Florida, and we did that plan. The design center asked me if I would help them, and I became a part of that team. And we had initial team meetings with the technical people and the project manager and the technical manager. And we looked at all the data we had. We spent about 2 days. We looked at all the data we had, historical data, and we decided that there was enough uncertainty about the entire site that this was one that we would probably have to go fence line initially to find out what we had. So we developed what we thought with our project team at that point, what we thought was a reasonable approach to characterize that site. Well, a couple of weeks later, we met with the regulators and city and county and state folks, and we presented that to them. And then they made some suggestions, and we changed a little bit. And then we put those agreements in the PWS and sent it out for bid, and so that the contractor who won that contract, they knew exactly what they were faced with and the agreements that we had made. And as a result, when we finally went to the public and we had about 250 irate public participants at that first meeting, we had a combined approach. We had the entire project team had bought into that approach that we were doing, and it worked very well there. Okay. Another thing on the performance work statements, make sure the entire MRS is included. The first thing we're going to do when we review the remedial investigation report is we're going to go into the appropriate database and take a look at what's reported and make sure that all that acreage is included, okay, because we have to address all of it, not just part of it. And another thing is don't limit the contractor to the amount of acreage they can investigate in transects and mini-grids. again, the project team is going to have to make those decisions. If the contractor needs more, if the team feels that they need more data to fully characterize it, by all means, go out and collect that data. We don't want to not determine where our nature's extent is simply because we're trying to save a few dollars on the contract. We really need to get that data and get that fully investigated. Okay, the next. Now, I put this slide in because if you can see that the dotted line on the outside, that is the actual MRS. But this team looked at the usage of that and determined that based on the usage of this site, that they only needed to collect data inside this box to fully characterize this entire MRS. Okay, so that's another thing that the team needs to make sure is that when they collect data, they are getting data that's going to represent the entire site and not just part of it. Okay, so make sure that they're getting the data in the right place is what it amounts to. Okay, now you've got to determine the data needs and quality, okay? And what is the ultimate outcome? Determine what receptors use the site and how they use that site. And what are the remedial action objectives? What are we trying to do? What do we want to do? When I first started working with Heidi Novotny up in Omaha, about and we were trying to determine and develop the principles to be used on MMRP sites. She kept saying, you got to start with the end in mind. And I didn't appreciate that. I heard the words. I didn't understand the meaning. And I have grown to really, really understand that now. And you've got to go out there and find out, what are we trying to do on the end, okay? And again, how much data is necessary to evaluate, be remedial alternatives to make decisions? All PDT members have to agree on that. They must agree on that. This is the amount of data we need in order to fully characterize and determine our remedial alternatives and to make the decisions. And decisions made early in the process determine what alternatives make sense. The amount of data required to support characterization and the alternative analysis, and the quality of that required data. How much data and the quality. Okay, we've got to keep that in mind throughout the process. Okay, next is remedial action objectives. And this is something else that's been misunderstood. And this is a bad RAO. Limit interaction with surface and subsurface mech. That's too broad, much too vague. And without specifics, it's impossible to develop the appropriate alternatives and to make the protectiveness statements in the feasibility study and the decision document and protectiveness determinations during the 5-year. Limit interaction with UXO during recreational activities, which currently includes surface use and subsurface use to a depth of 1 foot below ground surface. It identifies the contaminants and the hazards of concern and the media, identifies the exposure pathways and the routes and the receptors. It provides a clear basis for discussing and developing the appropriate alternatives for that site. And it can support those protective statements and determinations. So these are the examples of a good and a bad RAO. Okay, next slide. Now, I saw this come in not too long ago. And this is identifying the receptors and activities. And these are good examples of a thorough process to determine who uses that site and how do they use it. And I just go through one of them. I'll go through the first one. You can have the rest of them. You can read the rest. But park workers, there are receptors that use that site. Then there are adults responsible for groundskeeping/maintenance and teaching educational programs. However, teachers from the education center were not evaluated quantitatively as separate receptors because it was assumed that their exposure to contaminated media is equal to or less than those of the park, groundskeeping, and maintenance workers. The park worker is exposed to surface and subsurface soil. The park worker was elevated at all EUs. And then you can go through recreational adults, recreational children and students, and then hypothetical residents in case this was land use was converted to residential. But I thought this was very good. It shows the kind of detail you really need to get on the receptors. Who uses the property and how do they use it? Okay. Okay, next slide, I want to go over institutional analysis. I'm going to finish with this one. But why is this needed during characterization? Okay. If land use controls are a potential alternative, data required to analyze the alternative must be collected during the RI. Okay, I've got to know if I'm going to do land controls. The federal government and the Corps, we don't have any authorities whatsoever on that property. The authorities are the city, the county, the state. They have authority on that. And you got to determine who has authority. First, you have to determine what you think is necessary on this site, and then how it's going to be done, and then who has the authority to do that. And I first ran into this at Tierra Santa. Tierra Santa was one of the early projects. It was so early that there was no institutional analysis done. And then this was the first 5-year review. And the CX did that review, that 5-year review. And the then mayor of San Diego happened to live in Tierra Santa. And she was very, very helpful and very concerned. And so as a team, we formed a project team, and we determined what we thought needed to be done in a way of controls to make that safe. And we met with all of the agencies and the state or the city entities, and we determined that we needed to have sign that we needed to keep the signs up. So part of the we found out who had the authority to put the signs in. Were they willing to put them in? Yes. Who was going to maintain those signs? Who would inspect those signs? Who would replace them if they became damaged? And all that was determined. We determined educational material. The Corps agreed to develop the material. We determined how it was going to be passed out. It was going to be passed out to the school students to take home to the parents. And then the schools agreed that how they were going to or determine how it was going to be done. They signed up to that. And then permits. We found out who issued permits when property owners wanted to put in a pool or something. And a part of that permit process is they had to agree to have construction support on that site. So all this was done, and a responsibility matrix was signed. We said who was responsible, what they were going to do, and they signed that they were willing to do it. It worked very well on that site. Okay, what is needed? Determine what agencies have authorities on the site. That's what we did. Determine what property owners are willing to do. Again, we don't have any control over that property and property owner. If they're willing to have signs or a fence, then they have to agree to that. But if they decide to take it down, there's nothing we can do. Again, determine how educational material would be delivered to the property owners. We had another site where in the decision documents, we determined that the Corps would provide safety training in the schools. And then when it came to the five-year review, found out it wasn't done, and the state pointed their fingers at the Corps. Well, the problem, real problem, was that the principals in the schools didn't have the time and wouldn't allow or give the Corps the time to present it. So, and that, had we done the institutional analysis up front, we would have known that they didn't have the time, so that wasn't a viable alternative. Okay, that was the last bullet on that one. So those are the things that this needs to be done. This, because if you're going to have land use controls, you need to know how much data to collect. So you need to know if they're willing to implement those. Okay, next slide. Do we have any questions?
Bill, you have either thoroughly educated everybody or put everybody to sleep, because we haven't had a lot of questions. We did have one that came in, though. Well, actually, I see two, three that have popped up. And one of them, the person that came in, it may have already been answered by your last slide, but it was really, you know, it was what's an institutional analysis. And so I know you talked about it some on the last slide, but maybe if you want to take a few seconds, step back from it and say, well, you know, describe what an institutional analysis really, what it is.
Okay, what it is, it is understanding or talking to the different agencies that have controls, and what they are willing, what their authorities are over that property, and what they're willing to do. And are they willing to implement those authorities? It's like the schools. The schools are the ones that are going to give us the time. Well, if that institution is not willing to give us the time in order to go in and do our training, then that's not a viable alternative to be considered. If you want to prevent people from digging, if somebody has the authority, it's like if it's controlled by, say, the Park Service, if they are willing to not allow people to dig, then that's a control they have. But we have to know that. Then if we're going to adjust or control people's behavior, receptors' behavior at a site, we have to know how to do that. And if the Park Service would refuse to do that, then that's a control they have. So we have to understand what controls they have and are they willing to enforce those. Does that answer your question? Dwayne?
Okay. I think that is good. We had kind of a follow-up question that I just wanted to clarify, though, that came in stating that institutional analysis was really synonymous or another term for land use controls, and that's really not the case. Institutional analysis looks at how implementable land use controls might be.
Right.
You know, having a remedy of zoning a particular area for agricultural surface use only may be a perfectly acceptable remedy, but if a county is unwilling to take that step to implement that zoning, unless they're willing to commit to that, then that particular land use control is not applicable. So the institutional analysis serves to answer those questions of can those land use controls be implemented? Who has the authority to do certain things land use control-wise, and whether those whether there can be commitments agreed to put those remedies in place. So institutional analysis is linked to land use controls, but they're not synonymous. Let's see, here's a question. When do you recommend that the institutional analysis be carried out, before or after the RI field work?
I recommend it's got to be carried out, I think, before, because you have to know how much data you want to collect in the field, and you collect that data to see if you need data to support those land use controls, to support those alternatives. And so if you know that up front, it could and very well drive you to collect certain data or say, I don't need certain data.
Okay, very good. Let's see, we got a couple more minutes, and I'm kind of going down the list. We've had several questions that have come in, and I'll say, we had because Bill used some examples of characterization and regarding right of entry limitations, and we've had some questions that have come in about right of entry, but I'm really kind of I'd like to defer those. We can answer those individually. The session, you know, today is about character, site characterization, and so I really don't want to take up a lot of time going over the right of entry policy that's unique to individual programs or whatever. So if we could, I'm going to try to stick to those questions that are applicable for site characterization. Here's one, Bill. This is an interesting one that came in. Do you recommend that the CX be included as a PDT member?
It's a role that we used to play. I don't know whether we have the people right now to do that like we used to. I think that we can be advisors at least. I think that they should be able to come to us when they have concerns and questions about characterization or about certain things. And in that respect, yeah, we could very easily be team members.
Okay, very good. Time for one last question that I'm going to throw to you, Bill. If unacceptable risk or hazards drive the FS, how and when does MECHA fit in the RI or FS process? Is it used during the RI and repeated again in the FS? If it is an FS tool, how are hazards addressed in the RI?
What the MECHA does is allows you to say that if I implement this alternative, I can score it. You know, you can score the different alternatives, and get an idea of how low of how it's going to affect or that alternative will affect the overall site.
Okay, very good. All right, well, Bill, I think that we're out of time for your particular agenda item, and very much appreciate it. Good scoop, good info. Appreciate you sharing that. Our next speakers are with Neptune and Company, and this was going to be co-presented by Paul Black. Paul is the CEO of Neptune and Company. This is going to be by Paul Black and Kate Catlett. Paul is evidently in England and unable to connect to the webinar, so which is probably just as good. He's in England. We probably wouldn't be able to understand his accent while he was over there anyway. So Kate is she's going to run the presentation solo, and they have used quite a few environmental statistics and probabilistic modeling to address environmental problems. And I keep picturing the movie Moneyball, only applied to munitions projects when I think of that. And so with that, Kate, I'm gonna turn the presentation over to you.
Thank you very much. It is a pleasure to be here on this webinar today to share with you this approach that we've used out at Fort Missoula. It's exciting to share with you all what we've been doing and hopefully give you some idea of what we've done in this probabilistic modeling kind of world in the munitions arena. I've really just enjoyed Bill's talk a lot, and we have a lot in common. Really, the bottom line is, what decision do you need to make about your site, and what data do you need to collect? And this Bayesian approach really fits in to that very well. This is a picture of Fort Missoula, or actually it's the Blue Mountain Training Area, which is near Fort Missoula. It's a beautiful area that people come to regularly for jogging, hiking, horseback riding. Their kids, their dogs come, and they use it quite regularly before work, during lunches. I'm up here in Bozeman, Montana, and I love the area where we live. This site was also used as a training area for the Montana National Guard, and therefore there were munitions of concern on this site, which we got to help investigate.
Katie, we just have a brief request. If you could possibly just speak a little bit louder into your phone, that'd be helpful.
Sure, you bet. Is that better?
Thank you. That's better. Thank you.
You bet. So there are many sites, as we all know, that need characterization and cleanup from met contamination. And we need to continue to find more efficient ways of doing so that are also technically defensible. And we at Neptune believe that one approach for doing that would be using Bayesian statistics, which we see Bayesian statistics basically as formalized common sense, formalized in the sense that it's quantitative. It provides insights into risk. It can help prioritize actions and inform risk reduction options. Bayesian statistics is especially good for sites where there's little or no MEC expected, because we'll get into this a little bit more later, but basically Bayesian statistics allows you to ask, what's the real risk involved at the site? And do we need to be looking really hard here at this site where there's little or no MEC expected, or do we need to not worry about it too much? And it gives you a quantitative means of doing that. So, formalized common sense. Basically, what a lot of folks are doing at sites are using and integrating historical information, expert knowledge on the site, as well as historical data, survey data that's been done. And the Bayesian process allows you to put it all together quantitatively. And I'll show you a little bit of the quantitative later. I don't want to lose you too much in the statistics, but I want to share with you a little bit of what we mean by formalizing and quantifying. So it allows you to account for uncertainty as well as include your costs and value judgments. So what do the stakeholders want to know about the site? Or what do the stakeholders want to use the site for? How valuable is it to them to be able to get out and use the site for these different uses? And so that the Bayesian process allows you to quantify that. Here's another picture of
of the Blue Mountain training area. You can see the horseback riders with their dogs out at the site. There's a bunch of trails that crisscrossed target areas and such. So it was an interesting site to look at. We worked with Weston Solutions on this site. It's a Montana Army National Guard site. We worked with Weston Solutions, who is a prime contractor, and we worked with other great project team members to do this RIFS. We have had to do a time-critical removal action for the site, and it is currently in the FS phase. So the main munitions that were of concern at this site are the 3.5-inch rockets, 40-millimeter rocket grenades, and handheld grenades. The surprise at the site was that the rocket grenade range wasn't really where we thought it was going to be, so that made things interesting. But the bottom line, which still stood true throughout the investigation, that was that we didn't really expect much UXO present. And that's how it turned out at the end as well. I'm having the technical issue here where I don't see a picture of the site coming up. So we'll skip that one.
Yeah, Kate, I'm not quite sure what's going on with that.
Yeah, I don't know either. That's okay. The site basically just had four main target areas that It had four main target areas. I'll just tell you what's there, and there's trails crisscrossing the site. There's areas in the trees. There's sloped areas. The mountains provided that a natural backstop berm for the site. So that's the bottom line for that. So standard methods that have been used, and that we used some as well for this site, are VSP and UXO estimator. And these statements are kind of the statistical statements as a background behind what these methods do. And this is one of VSP's options. When you don't expect much mech on the site, you can use this this option in VSP, which is basically a confirmation sampling kind of option, to say, well, is the area really mech-free? And then UXO estimator gives you a kind of quasi-risk statement of a mech rate. What's the mech density that you expect at the site? But you have to assume that there's a constant mech density across these areas of the site, or else divide the site up into different areas. But the bottom line is neither of these is a risk statement. And that's where the Bayesian statistics does it a little bit differently, as it involves the risk of an incident happening. And so I don't want to leave you with any kind of impression that we think that these tools are not any good, because we use them, and we think that there's a lot of value in these. But on some sites, you want to do something just a little bit more. And maybe it's like getting a new car that gets a little bit better gas mileage. It could save you some money down the road. Or maybe it's a little bit of improved safety factor, that you get more bang for your buck for the money, that you know that you can clean up the site to a better degree. So that's what we're looking at. Bayesian statistics is very helpful when you're thinking about looking for a needle in the haystack. So what do we mean? A needle in the haystack is where classical statistics would say, go after the needle and find that needle no matter what it costs. But Bayesian statistics says, well, at some point, that needle's going to be too small, the haystack's going to be too big, and we don't really need to find the needle. So don't go looking for something that you don't really need to find. And how do you decide whether or not you need to find it? And that's part of the beauty of the Bayesian statistics, is we can use Bayesian statistics, Bayesian decision analysis, to come together as stakeholders and regulators, and the community to say, do we really need to go look for this needle? And then collect the data that's appropriate to look for the needle or to not. So for an example, if we're looking to show that there's 2 mech per acre on the site, we might need to sample 1.5 acres. But if we reduce that target using classical statistics, we have to sample more acres to get a lower rate of mech on the site, or a lower mech, to show that there's a lower mech density. And so that kind of brings up the question, too, of how do we decide how many mech per acre is acceptable? And we kind of have done that somewhat as an industry. I mean, we typically use 0.5 mech per acre or 0.25 mech per acre as inputs to UXO estimator and say, well, it's going to cost too much to show that there's less than that on the site. Even if we might really know that there's less than half a mech or 1 mech per 2 acres, even if we know that there's a lot less than that on site, that's what we're going to choose to use for the statistics, because that makes cost sense. So we're kind of doing a cost analysis that the Bayesian statistics allows us to formalize when we set that risk. And for sites where we don't really expect to find mech, we should be looking in areas where either we expect to find it, because if we don't expect to find it, and we look where we most expect, and then get some coverage, some good spatial coverage in there as well, then we should be even more confident that there's no mech on site or very little on site. So that's kind of the philosophy, or look where the risk is greatest. And a lot of companies do this already. We sample trails on sites because we know the public on recreational sites such as this one, because we know the public's going to be there, and that's the place to look the most, because that's where people might most likely come in contact with mech. So we've talked a little bit about risk. Probably have some feel for intuitively. It's something that's in essence a part of the mech haw already. But put in a probabilistic statement, we can look at the probability of an incident occurring, or the rate that an incident might occur. And that rate of an incident occurring is the probability of an incident given that somebody encounters it, times the probability of somebody encountering it given that the mech is there, given a mech density, times that mech density, times the rate of mech. And we could go into all sorts of exciting breakdowns of these probability statements and break them down further in terms of types of encounter, types of mech, what other factors would come into this mech risk statement. But this is the basic overall view of what we're looking at for mech risk. And so we used this concept of mech risk at Fort Missoula. But we started with UXO estimator that gave us the acreage that we needed to sample and the number of digs that we needed to dig on the trails. And then we used the Bayesian model to allocate the sampling effort. So we incorporated prior information or historical information regarding the mech density at the site. We used a non-homogeneous Poisson model, which basically means non-homogeneous, meaning we divided the site up into different areas where we felt the rate of mech or the mech density would be different. And Poisson models are used, they're great for using for sites where we need, where we have discrete items like mech contamination versus concentrations that have a more continuous more continuous distribution on the site, and maybe that's as much statistics as you all would like to know, but there are different ways of using statistics, different statistical models. So that's what we used for the spatial distribution of MEC. And then I need to make sure I keep moving here, so I might skip a couple of these things. But basically, we prioritized the digs from the analog surveys of the trails, and then we specified DGM grids with this Bayesian model. So what we needed, I mean, one of the most difficult things with modeling is getting good inputs, right? Because if you don't have good inputs, you don't have good outputs. Garbage in, garbage out. So we wanted to make sure we had good, valuable inputs. So what we did was we did an expert elicitation of UXO experts that were involved with the site. These experts knew the site pretty well. They knew the historical information on the site. They had been out there on the site on site visits, and they had a lot of experience from other sites. And so we took each of these factors, that rate of MEC, the density of MEC, if you will, and had the experts help inform us on what these inputs should be to our model. So we ended up having 12 different regions, or different areas within the site. We broke it up into 12 subsections that had different, we felt had different likelihoods of having MEC, areas that were not in the target area, areas that were right in the target area, firing point areas, maybe nearby to the target areas. And we had four different target areas, so we divided those up. Each of the four target areas were four of the different regions. And we did a similar quantification of public encounter. What's the probability of somebody encountering it if there's vegetation there? Is somebody just off the trail? If it's heavy vegetation, maybe nobody will be walking on it. If there's not, maybe somebody might go off the trail and find MEC under vegetation. Or similarly steep slopes, maybe they won't be hiking off the trail on the steep slopes or in the marsh. But it was kind of difficult to come up with too much differences in the encounter and probability for this site. Other sites, there might be a huge difference, but within this one site, it was it wasn't too much different along the different areas. Similarly, we did this expert elicitation for the probability of a detonation happening given an encounter. And the bottom line here is that different types of MEC will be more likely to cause harm than other types of MEC. And the MEC call includes this as well in their process, and we did a similar sort of elicitation just for the type of MEC that were on this site. And the 40 millimeter rounds were decided to be the highest probability of detonating and causing harm if somebody encountered them. So with the surveys, they used analog instrumentation on the trails. And we were asking the question of how likely is an anomaly to be MEC given you come across an anomaly. So as you're going along the trail, how do you decide which anomalies to dig? And we were somewhat fortunate at Fort Missoula here to be able to survey a good bit of the trails before we implemented this model. Some other sites, it's too big to be able to do this. And so field crews often do this on their own without a real quantification. The experts in the field know a lot more than what we usually quantify with this type of work. So we tried to, in our expert elicitation, get at some of that. How do you decide which anomalies to dig? You've got some spatial coverage, you've got some perhaps other cultural debris present on the surface. So you say, well, this is probably a lot of trash in here. This isn't likely mech. Or if you've seen frag recently, maybe you would dig something nearby because you would have a good idea that it might be a munitions item. So bottom line is field experience. You can't beat getting out in the field. I think I've covered most of these, but the bottom, I got to move this along again. Bottom line is we took each anomaly and ran it through our model based on these inputs that we were, that we elicited from the experts. And we decided whether or not to dig based on different criteria. If it fell above a certain risk threshold, we dug it for sure, and otherwise we weighted it. So if there was more, if there was an anomaly in a target area, say, we had a higher probability of digging that anomaly than if it was not in the target area. This is a color-coded figure of which anomalies we chose and kind of how the risk was. The greens were lower risk, and the reds and blues and pinks were higher risk. Another great thing about Bayesian statistics is that it allows you to do an adaptive design. So, I mean, this is stuff that you do out in the field anyways. When you get out in the field, sometimes you say, well, we got to change this. But the Bayesian model allowed us to formalize our changes and put quantitatively in why we wanted to change it. And again, there was no substitute for being out there. The field crews were very helpful, and it was great even for our statistical modelers to be out in the field and see what was happening. Our results showed that the model results agreed well with the UXO estimator original target densities, so that we had less than a half a meg per acre, which was good. Oh, pardon me. I work from home. Anyways, we showed less than a half a mech per acre, which was great. And hang on. It allowed us to easily incorporate the adaptive design as well as get acceptable rates of mech density, less than that target density, for all the regions of concern at the site. And then these are my conclusions. We basically, by using the Bayesian design, we were able to get a lower mech density estimate than using UXO estimator, which we were very pleased to see that and to implement it. And we were also able to use it and to apply it on the site in a successful manner. So it worked, which was great for us to be able to do on a munitions site. Again, the Bayesian approach was very good for a site like this with low expected mech rates. And we use this as a tool for allocating effort, but it could also be used to determine level of effort. So if we want to look in terms of saving money in the future, we could use it to say, well, how many samples do we need to collect? And how many targets do we really need to investigate down the road instead of just using UXOestimator to do that? Anyways, we are a small company, Neptune is, and we have used this approach in many different areas and applications, and we'd be happy to talk with you all more about Bayesian statistics anytime. Thank you for your time and attention.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Kate. We have a couple, looks like we have about 3 minutes left in your session, so I think we do have time for a few questions. The first question that popped up during your session was that isn't one problem that when the needle in the haystack is a bomb, it's a tougher sell to persuade stakeholders that you don't need to look for it? And I can take that one, and the answer is yes, it is a tougher sell. But if you want to elaborate on that, then please feel free.
Well, yes. UXO is a lot like nuclear waste, too, in that public perception world, and we deal with a lot of nuclear waste issues. The convincing the public that having one potential bomb out there is okay is it's difficult sometimes. I mean, sometimes it's not too big of a deal. Honestly, up here in Montana, we've had a good bit of success with interactions with the public where they're not overly worried about one bomb being out there. But the key to that is great stakeholder communication, great communication coming into a site before you do the work and talking to people about their concerns and doing some of this institutional analysis research that Bill was talking about and communicating with them about how likely it is that they really can come across that bomb that might be out, a black box, is a great way to start trying to help them understand that maybe that needle isn't worth looking for.
Right. Okay. One of the things, Kate, I meant to mention this before I even got into the questions, but I got ahead of myself. I apologize for not having the graphic on that one slide. We were able to figure out what happened there. If you needed us to, we can go back to that slide. By the time we figured it out, you were well on your way in the presentation. But I just wanted to offer that to you out of courtesy if you felt we needed to for your presentation.
Oh, thanks. I think we can just include that in the archive. People
okay.
To go back to it. Is that
okay.
If they really wanted to see it.
Very good. Okay, excellent. All right. Let's see. One last. We have about a minute left. So one last question, and I think you had a slide that had several bullets that kind of addressed this, but I'll see if you wanted to add anything to it. How do you prioritize digs from the analog detectors?
Yeah, good question. So what we did was, maybe this slide. So analog instrumentation doesn't give you a huge amount of information, right? It's basically a hit or not. And sometimes the guys in the field told us that well, they could tell if it was a larger hit or not. But what we did was go through our model here and put these inputs forth on the analog hits. So if it was a hit, let me go back to this slide. So let's see, do I have an arrow here? Maybe not. Yes, there we go. So if it was a hit out here where it was outside the target area, it got a lower ranking as it went through our model. As it as we went in through here, this was actually one of the main target demolition areas. these hits got a higher ranking, and so we dug more of the hits here within this target area. So basically, I'd be happy to share more information on the details of the model, but basically what we did was go through this this probability model and put in inputs and got an output likelihood or probability of an incident and used that to prioritize the digs.
Excellent.
Is that mostly clear?
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's good. If we have your POC info up on the website, if anybody has more detailed requests or for information, then they can either contact you directly, or we can put them in touch with you.
Thank you. And
we are
for the background noise there.
Okay, no, that's fine. That's very fine. We very much appreciate you putting together the presentation and providing it to our community. Looked like really good stuff. And at this point in the agenda, we're scheduled for an intermission. You know, a full afternoon of webinar is quite a bit, and so I don't want to read any headlines about someone dying of deep vein thrombosis from a Tour of Engineers webinar. So please take the time to stretch your legs, run and get some tea or something, which is probably what I'll do. And we will be back. Looks like in it says 15 minutes, but probably about 14 minutes now. Thank you very much.
This is Jean Ballant. We are going to go ahead and start that intermission, just as Dwayne said. I'm just going to check very quickly and see if I can get one of our upcoming speakers. Julie Kaiser, if you're on the telephone lines, could you just speak up and confirm that you're there with me?
Yep, I'm here, Jean.
Okay, great. We're going to do just a very quick system check with you.
Yeah.
And we are going to go ahead and actually, I'm going to elevate your privileges really briefly.
Okay.
I'm going to give you rights so you can click through this particular deck that's up there right now.
Okay.
The same rule or same rights will work for you regardless of which presentation
All right.
is up there. I'm going to also give you rights on two different ones because it looks like you may have come in and out. Okay. So there should be a green pointer up on the screen.
Yeah.
You could try to click
uh-huh.
on that and drag it around. Beautiful.
Yep.
All right. And then
yeah.
the only other thing is that your slides will be bigger when it's your turn. But if you do mm-hmm. see in the lower left corner of those slides, there is a there are arrows kind of pointing to the left and right on the window showing the slide.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Feel free to click those and see if those will advance. Yep.
Yep.
And, you can also
Great.
Use the arrow keys on your keyboard. To do left and right arrow keys
okay.
on the keyboard will do exact same function.
Great.
Okay,
can I look
so
at
we
the
have
participants real quick?
Yeah, actually you can. I'll allow you to maintain those rights during the rest of the intermission, so you'll be able to browse through that participant list as well.
Awesome. Gosh, there's a lot of folks. Oh my God, 150.
Actually, we have
okay.
a much larger audience, so I'll send you a full roster when we're done. So we're
yeah,
going to go ahead and
that's
remain
helpful
on the break.
For now. Okay. Yep.
And again, we are on intermission, so for all of the participants still with us, appreciate that real quick system check we had to do with one of our upcoming speakers. We will remain on intermission for the next 12 minutes or so, and we'll go ahead and resume the technical portion of our broadcast here at 2:45 p.m. Eastern. The lines will remain open, but you may not hear any audio because we won't have anybody actively speaking for the next 12 minutes or so. If you need to hop off and dial back in, leave the meeting environment and come back in, you're certainly welcome to do so.
Okay, I would like to welcome everybody back to the second half of our webinar session this afternoon. And our next presentations from Jay Clausen. Jay is he's a physical research scientist with the Corps of Engineers, the Engineer Research and Development Center, our Cold Regions Lab up in New Hampshire. And Jay has worked on a number of research projects involving energetics. And so I understand it, Jay, you're working on a PhD even. So good luck with that. Let us know how it goes, and we're going to turn it over to you.
Thank you for the introduction, Dwayne, and the opportunity to speak today. So I'm going to be talking about a proposed approach for characterizing large military ranges. And so what I'm talking about here is ranges probably greater than 50 acres in size. And right now, we really don't have a systematic approach of, you know, how to deal with these large ranges in terms of identifying MEC and MC in a cost-effective manner. And the focus of this presentation is primarily on MC, munitions constituents, primarily RDX, HMX, and TNT. And how do we, you know, estimate the source term of that material on a range, or how do we delineate, characterize, and then ultimately, you know, come up with some sort of soil contaminant loading if groundwater is of interest. So some of the questions or issues that are out there right now, you know, what is the utility of wide area assessment technologies to help identify areas of high density of munitions and explosives of concern, MEC? That's been the essential work that's been done to date in terms of using wide area assessment. But could the technologies be used to help identify MC as well? And then there's this question or issue of how do you integrate all of the sensor data, such as the side aperture radar, SAR, or hypospectral imaging, orthophotography, LIDAR, the digital geophysical mapping, and then all of the historical information that you have for the site as well. And then another question that kind of exists out there is, whether or not the MC is co-located with MEC or high-density areas of MEC, craters, or metal fragments. We really don't really have a handle on that at this point in time. And, you know, it'd be nice if there is some sort of relationship there between MEC and MC that we could then use that information to help with our sample designs. You know, we always want to balance the number of samples against cost. So what is the scale of soil sampling that's important? That kind of comes back to your objectives for the project. And then one issue that's been increasingly or is in increasing interest is this approach of using incremental sampling methodology on ranges. So how appropriate is that as well for these large ranges? So one possible approach One possible approach is, again, integration of your ancillary data that you're already collecting at the sites. This is like your target information, range fans, maybe if you've done some intrusive work at the site, you know, the location of MEC or UXO, and then combining that information with the various sensor modalities, the wide area assessment technologies, the airborne magnetometer, and then some of the ground-based geophysical data, and using all that information to inform you to develop your sampling designs, including the potential application of ISM to provide some sort of characterization information on MC distribution. So for those who are not familiar with the wide area assessment technologies, they're your high-altitude platforms. These typically carry your LIDAR, your SAR, your hyperspectral imaging, and your orthophotography. The low-altitude, which is typically helicopter-borne, is your airborne magnetometers. And then your ground-based digital geophysics mapping is the EM61 technology and the metal mapper. A little bit of history. The LIDAR and the other technologies have been demonstrated to locate MEC directly or indirectly. In the case of LIDAR, you're looking at craters or crater density, and then from that potentially inferring your high-density zones of MEC. The application methodology for wide area assessment has been established. The limitations are relatively well known for LIDAR, the ortho, the HeliMag, and the DGM, less so for the SAR and HSI. And then some of the individual sensor data analysis techniques have been developed. In terms of unknowns, again, how to leverage the wide area assessment information to infer presence of MC and aid in your sampling designs. The utility of SAR is still somewhat questionable, as is HSI, to find MEC or infer presence of MC. In the case of HSI, there's been some work in the black ops world with that technology, and it has been successful for identifying MC, but that information kind of hasn't carried over to the environmental industry at this point in time. And integration analysis of multiple sensor data sets, you know, some of those techniques have been worked out. There's still, I think, work to be done there. So a little bit on the sampling approach. Probably some of you have heard of this incremental sampling methodology. It's a different approach than our conventional grab or discrete sampling. In this case, what you're focused in on is an area of interest or an area of concern, which we call a decision unit. And then that's a process of systematically collecting increments from that area, combining the increments together to form a single sample. And then it also involves improved sample processing back in the laboratory. History, we've done a lot of work here at CREL looking at the conventional field sampling and sample preparation methods for explosives, and have found that they yield non-reproducible results. Typically, the data is quite biased. It's typically not repeatable. You go back and collect like duplicate samples for representative results of the area sampled. What you typically get there is an average concentration for the area. And the process has been incorporated into EPA method 8030B, both for the field sampling and the sample preparation. And that's the method for energetic constituents. And we're also working with the EPA to basically incorporate the same changes into EPA method 3050B, which is the metal digestion method. So there'll be some changes to the sample preparation procedures in the laboratory, as well as an appendix talking about how to incorporate the ISM sampling in the field. Some of the unknowns about ISM is, you know, what's the appropriate scale sampling on large ranges? Most of the work that we've done to date has been limited to about 2.5 to 5 acres in size. So how far, you know, can we extend this? You know, if we're working on a 1,000 or a 10,000 acre range, you know, can we have 10 acre or 100 acre decision units? You know, how can we scale the technology up to these larger ranges? And then again, there's this question of co-location of MC with MEC. Really don't have a handle on that at this point in time. A little bit about the technologies. Wide area assessment, which is typically referred to as the fixed wing platform technologies. We can cover thousands of acres per day. We can perform base-wide or installation-wide assessments. Typically, they've been used for identifying MEC, defining areas of concern, and identifying areas that have low potential for MEC. The helicopter-based mapping basically involves a magnetometer, can cover hundreds of acres per day, and it's somewhat limited in terms of terrain. Principally, it's been used for identifying not individual MECs, but locations of anomalies or groupings of MEC, so target detection, MRS definition. And then the ground-based geophysics can cover about tens of acres per day. If there's a lot of vegetation, then the rate of coverage is going to be less. It's been used to verify the wide area assessment data, both for MEC detection and MEC characterization, and then target discrimination as well. A little bit about some of the other technologies as well. In terms of some of the limitations and the applications, the LIDAR and the orthophotography are, again, principally deployed on the high-altitude platform. Principally, they yield topographic information, so craters or berms, surface topography, potentially targets. Both technologies are principally limited by dense foliation. For the most part, they can see through trees, but if you're in a tropical forest or something like that, then it might be more problematic. The SAR, again, is a high-altitude deployed sensor. It detects surface metal debris. I'm not as familiar with that particular technology, so I'm not sure what the sensor limitations are, but I'm sure there are some. The HSI, or the hyperspectral imaging, is a high-altitude deployed sensor again. It can discriminate between surface non-metallic objects. It has been used to identify certain MC constituents. The limitations are spectrally similar materials can be easily confused. And then if you have water-saturated materials or vegetation, that's potentially problematic. The HeliMag is a low-altitude deployed sensor. It detects surface and shallow subsurface metal debris, MEC and UXO, and other man-made objects. It's terrain or vegetation limited because it has to fly fairly low to the ground surface. And then ferrous geology is potentially problematic. And then the ground-based geophysical techniques, such as the magnetometry, the EM61, or the metal mapper, they're used to detect shallow subsurface metal debris, UXO, MEC, and other man-made metallic objects. Again, vegetation is somewhat of a limiting factor, and as well as potentially ferrous geology. A little bit more detail on the LIDAR. Typically, in terms of your lateral resolution, it's about 40 to 50 centimeters, and your vertical resolution is about 10 centimeters. You typically get two terrain models, a bare earth model, and then a vegetation model. So when the LIDAR operates, it sends out hundreds of thousands of pulses per second. Some of those pulses bounce off the vegetation, and other pulses pass between the leaves or whatever vegetation you have and hit the ground surface and then return. So you can get information on both the topography of the vegetation surface as well as the ground surface itself. So this is an example of a orthophotograph of a site. You can see it's densely forested. I really can't tell from this whether or not there is any MEC on the site or any indication that there might be MEC on the site based on craters. If you look at the next slide, you can see a number of craters in the circle and some of the arrows. So this is what's called the bare earth model. The vegetation has been removed, and clearly you can see that there are craters present. So, maybe from this we could infer that there might be some MEC existing in these locations. The white dots represent various anomalies. And then the second figure from the left, let's see if I can activate the arrow. Yeah, second image from the left here is a LIDAR image. And we can see, again, individual anomalies. And actually we can see the road that goes through the site. And then this third image here is basically like a color-enhanced version of the second image. And so all the various anomalies are colored red. And then the image on the far right includes combination of the SAR and the LIDAR. So where you're seeing, let me get this without the slide moving around. But wherever you're seeing an anomaly, that's the location where both the SAR and the LIDAR suggest that there's some co-located anomaly. So once you have your wider assessment information, another approach is then go down to the ground surface, and we have these digital geophysical mapping technologies, the EM61 and the metal mapper. Again, these detect ferrous and non-ferrous munitions. Typically, there's two different approaches to sampling. These either are transect for like a site-wide anomaly detection. And we can locate the size, potentially shape, and orientation of individual targets. And then there's a grid-based approach that can be used as well for characterization. There are a number of different types of estimation techniques for analyzing this data. Again, we can discriminate between different types of targets, both MEC and non-targets, other metallic material, debris, magnetic geology. The anomalies between different transects potentially are detected, and then you can use varying software that basically interpolates through various Kriging routines to connect the anomalies together. And there's existing software out there, such as the GeoSoft, Oasis Montage, UX Detect, some subroutines in ArcGIS and VSP, and I'm sure there are others out there as well. So the next step following your collection of your wide area assessment data and maybe some ground-based geophysics is then using that information to identify your high value anomalies and identify your decision units. And then use that information to map out potentially the density of munitions inferred from the sensor technologies. In some cases, you might have some information from the site where people have gone out and actually validated stuff on the surface, or maybe even dug up some anomalies already. So you might have that ground truth information to use as well. But again, what we want to do is we want to combine all this information together and use that information to help select the decision units where we're going to do the MC sampling. So to some degree, we're doing this for some projects. For other projects, we're not there yet. So once we've got the data from the various sensor technologies and we have identified the decision units, then the next step would be to collect the field samples. And typically the way we've conventionally done it is we've done this through the collection of discrete or grab samples. Sometimes we use some sort of gridding or systematic pattern to collect the samples. And often cases when we have the regulators involved and there's some biasing to where the samples are collected from. So the incremental sampling methodology is a little bit different. We're not interested in individual points. We're interested in an area of contamination or a particular area. And so what we do here is we collect a series of increments across the decision unit that go into the same sample container, and then they constitute a single sample for the area. So on this particular diagram, you see red arrows and green arrows. Those represent the pathway of somebody walking and collecting the increments. And then the X's and the O's represent individual increments. And so what is done is you start out one corner of the area of interest, collect an increment, put it in your sample container, walk a few steps, collect another increment, put it in the same sample container, and then continue on throughout the whole area that you're going to sample. And so in this situation here on this pin, though, is, you know, what size of decision unit is appropriate. Here I'm showing a 10-acre decision unit outlined in black. And then within that I have 4 or 5-acre decision units. And then within the upper left corner I'm showing 25 2.5-acre decision units. And most of the work that we've done to date with explosives and propellant compounds has been typically less than an acre in size. We have gone up to 2.5 to 5 acres. But again, what's important in terms of characterizing these areas, and that's largely a function of the objectives of your particular project. So, you know, some of the other speakers have mentioned, you know, project planning up front is key. You need to know, you know, what type of munitions have been used on the site, and what are the characteristics of those munitions. So if you have a detonation, you know, how far do you expect contamination to be spread away from that detonation point? Is it, you know, a couple meters in diameter? Are we talking about an acre, you know, tens of acres? You know, how big of an area? And that will also then impact your size of the decision unit, because the spacing between your increments is important. And if you select too large of a decision unit, then the spacing will be such that if you have a small area of contamination or a small area of interest, then potentially you could skip over that contamination and not have an increment in your sample container that, you know, has what you're looking for. So this is just showing on this particular slide here the same ISM sampling approach kind of shrunk down to the 5-acre decision unit and then down to the 2.5-acre decision unit. And again, one thing I want to emphasize is that the scale of the decision units, there is no right or wrong to that. It's fully dependent upon the objectives of your study and the characteristics of your site. And oftentimes you need to think about what's going to be the end product of your investigation. You know, do you think you're going to find something and you're going to have to do some sort of surface removal action? Then you may want to size your decision units based on that. Or is your end target some sort of exposure point concentration for a risk assessment? Then that might require you to go down to a 1-acre or even a 1/2-acre decision unit.
Jay, this is Dwayne. I'm going to interrupt real briefly and just mention that it looks like you've got about 8 minutes left in your presentation. I think you've got quite a few more slides to go through.
Yep, yep. Some of them will go through pretty quick here.
Excellent.
So again, this is just showing that pattern before for the 10 acre. It's exactly the same. And so here we're showing the decision unit layout for these different sites, and the purple blob here is our contaminated area. And if you went with a 10 acre decision unit, you probably would be able to pick this up in a few increments. And then get a result that indicates you have contamination on the site. Obviously, if you went with the 2.5-acre decision unit, you would have 5 grids that would be contaminated and 25 in the upper left-hand zone that would be not contaminated. And then if you went with the 5-acre decision unit, you would have 2 decision units contaminated and 2 that were clean. So one approach might be if you're going to do some sort of screening assessment, maybe you start out with a 10-acre decision unit, screen the site with that, depending on how big a site you have, and then step down to the smaller scale. You know, one drawback with that approach is you're talking about multiple mobilizations. Now, if the contamination is a lot smaller and we went with a 10-acre decision unit, there's probably a pretty good likelihood that you would just potentially miss that contamination. So that's why I was talking about earlier, you know, the size of your decision unit is also a function of what you expect to find in the field. So after we've defined the decision units, it's a collection of the surface soil samples. Again, we're using all the data to define or target where those samples are collected. And one of the things I want to talk about here is in the second bullet, where we talk about collecting samples from different anomalous zones. So one thought process is to break up your area into high, medium, and low density areas. Based on what you expect to find on the range. And then if we go to the next slide, to use that information and use potentially an extrapolation approach, similar to what Katie was talking about earlier, where we define a number of decision units in our zone of probability and then randomly select a number of the decision units for sampling. So in this case, if we say we had a large area and we had, you know, 100 or 200 decision units, we would randomly select 59 of those. And if no MC detection occurred in any of those, then we'd have a 95% probability that the unsampled decision units would be clean. The problem with this approach, though, is if one MC is detected in one of the decision units, then the unsampled DUs will need to be sampled or some other sampling approach would have to be evaluated or reevaluated. So that's one drawback, and so this particular approach is primarily amenable to our low probability areas, probably taking more risk with the medium probability areas and then the high probability areas. You know, you expect to find something, so that approach is not really going to work. So the next series of slides just shows kind of this process. This is some information from a site. So we're showing an aerial photograph, and there's some boundaries on this particular slide of the insulation and different types of buildings. And then the next slide, 25, shows some LIDAR collected data, and from that, some anomalies, primarily based on crater density. And then the next slide shows, it says DGM, but that's not correct. This is actually the airborne magnetometer data. So we're showing anomalies associated with the magnetic signature, and the uncovered areas are the mountainous areas where the helicopter couldn't fly over on some of the ranges. And then we go to the next slide, and we see some different boundaries for the different ranges in green with some of the pre-existing information on the same slide. And then this final slide here actually shows decision unit layout selection. Those are the purple boundaries. And they're really hard to see on here, but in pink, there's actually a number of decision units or sampling units within the decision unit that were actually sampled. So some of this process is already being done. You know, most companies have GIS. We can incorporate all this data electronically and, you know, slice and dice the information. So that's basically what I'm talking about, but more of a formal process. So conclusion, for evaluating MC on large ranges, what I'm proposing is an integration of, you know, site-specific data that you already have collected, integrating that with wide area assessment data and then ground-based geophysics data. And then from that, identifying low, medium, high MEC MC zones, fusing all that information together to come up with our decision units, potentially using an extrapolation approach for our low-density areas, and then going out and actually collecting the sampling, the samples. One of the drawbacks with these wide area assessment technologies is cost. It's a, you know, fairly high cost to mobilize these technologies. But I think in the end run, you know, if we're talking, you know, tens of thousands of acres sites, that it might make sense to deploy these technologies because it's really not feasible to sample on the ground, you know, large areas like that and have some degree of confidence that you've adequately covered the area. And that's it.
Very good. Thanks, Jay. Appreciate it. I think we have just like maybe 1 minute left in your time slot. And one question came in. You know, your presentation is an approach for characterizing large military ranges. And so kind of what's the definition of range in this context?
I'm thinking primarily of small arms ranges on up to artillery. Well, not so much small arms ranges, but artillery, mortar, tank ranges. So, you know, ranges where we have impact areas that, you know, are 50 acres or more. I mean, we have lots of sites that have, you know, thousands of acres, hundreds of acres. And so, you know, does it make sense to physically go out and collect a soil sample from every acre on those impact areas? You know, and when we go out in the impact area, we have to have EOD personnel with us. So we're, you know, a mobilization, you're talking, you know, thousands of dollars a day, easy.
Okay, very good. Well, again, Jay, appreciate it. I believe it is time now to move on to our next presentation, which is going to be brought to us by, this was supposed to be another co-presented paper with Julie Kaiser and Debbie McKinley, but Debbie is sick today, is not able to join us. So Julie has offered to try to go it alone. She's going to be operating here with without a net. So Julie, I'm going to turn it over to you. Julie's with the Baltimore Military Munition Design Center. She's a project manager and team leader with that design center, has worked on munitions projects for a long time. So, Julie, take it away.
Thanks, Dwayne. If anybody saw the agenda, I did change the title. I wasn't able to tackle that topic because I don't really have a clue. But anyway, I am going to talk about some lessons learned. And first I'll start with Debbie's slides, and I apologize, but she does have a fever, and I think she's just on the delirious side and not able to even do it from home. So I am just going to really essentially, I have a few speaker notes, but essentially I'm just going to be able to read the slides for you. But I have talked to her over the months and years now. Debbie is a primary reviewer for a lot of RI documents that have come through the Design Center here in Baltimore, and we have had many, many documents. And Debbie's been with the Corps for a long time. She came from the St. Louis district. She's got a strong background in the in both the environmental and the munitions program, so she's a strong reviewer for both MEC and MC. So I really trust her opinions. She's a tough reviewer, so you might see some things that you know rub you a little bit the wrong way in terms of criticisms of the documents. But these are really just, you know, meant to be food for thought for those of you who are preparing and reviewing RI documents, from a lot of experience on Debbie's part in reviewing these things. So with that, I'll just start by saying DQOs, and I've heard Debbie say this several times, DQOs as well as the CSM, conceptual site model, you know, repeatedly she has seen that they are not fully developed or necessarily just fleshed out. And I know it's very tempting to gloss over both of these. I've been guilty of it myself. DQOs, problems not clearly stated, study goals are vague, information inputs are incomplete, decision rules incomplete or non-existent, often fail to address geophysics and the physical parameters. Not sure what she means there by physical parameters. And then the CSM, I guess these are specific things. She has found that the MC is not based on the specific MEC items that we would expect at the site. And I think specifically what she's talking about here is that there's a tendency for contractors to propose the full suite of explosives and metals rather than tailoring that list to the expected MEC items. And in the FUDS world, at least in my FUDS world, Debbie typically, by the way, has been reviewing a lot of documents for the active Army program, and she does do FUDs as well, but the majority of the documents she's reviewed, I think, have been for active Army. But in the FUDS program, we have made a real effort to tailor that list when we're analyzing for MC to the MEC items. And I know accessibility to the MIDAS database is limited now, so getting to specific constituents is a challenge. But we are, you know, your government contacts are here to help you get to that list. So I think that's what she's talking about there. She also mentioned that in Baltimore we have in many cases been able to tailor MC sampling to only when we to situations in the field where we're finding low order detonations. And on the active side, I think they do this through some kind of memorandum not an official memorandum of agreement, but some kind of memo. The short term is MC memo. So contact me or Debbie if you're interested in seeing an example of that. Travis McCown, who's the program manager, has facilitated that. For a lot of sites, we end up doing no sampling for MC at all, because in most cases, we don't see constituents unless there's low-order detonations, and we've been able to successfully high concentrations of munitions debris. That's typically, I think, the wording that gets put into these memos. But don't quote me on that. I actually haven't seen one. Anyway, also incorrect use of VSP and UXO estimator for developing geophysical approach. I'll go to the next slide. Sampling approach lacks rationale. The UFP QAP worksheet 17 specifically, I guess she has seen, which is the sample design and rationale. That's where we're supposed to, you know, talk about why we're taking the samples that we are taking for MC. And apparently she's been seeing just a reiteration of, you know, the field program, how we're going to collect samples instead of why. Information to support the risk assessment or the feasibility study is not always part of the RI scope. We have been caught not having enough background data, which we need for the risk assessment, not conducting lead shot counts at skeet ranges, not conducting physical soil parameters analysis during the RI. So important to think about all the elements that are necessary for the risk assessment or the feasibility study. And let's see if she has notes on that. Okay, independent QC not implemented in the field. Lack of communication between the Corps and the contractor. I guess Debbie has run into situations where the Corps thinks the contractor is doing independent QC and the contractor thinks the Corps is doing it. So there needs to be, in her opinion, a discussion of field QC roles and responsibilities during Army-only TPP meetings or other appropriate times. The work plan or the QAP often have poorly defined QC roles and responsibilities. In some instances, lack of independent QC oversight has resulted in poor quality data and or low confidence data. Baltimore is working with contractors to ensure independent audits are conducted for each type of sampling effort early in the program to evaluate adherence to work plan and QAP and to make early corrections to improve data quality. Poorly, so I think that covers covers it. Miscommunication, it sounds like, about QC. And in the RI report, Debbie has found that key information has often been buried in the appendices. There is a real temptation to just defer to the appendices. I have noticed this as well. A key point is that the data is merely presented. It's not evaluated or put into perspective, and I'm going to talk about that later as well. Insufficient or non-existent data usability assessment. She's talking about the laboratory analytical data here. It's not based on the park parameters. The data usability assessment needs to talk about precision, accuracy, representativeness, comparability, and completeness. I always forget what all those are. The assessment also has to talk about field activities, data qualifiers, and deviations from the planning documents, and the effect are discussed. Not all RI reports include them. She has found a very cookie-cutter laundry list approach has been taken, and if anybody has attended ARAR's training, they know, you know, we're supposed to talk to the attorneys and get specific about ARARs. So I wouldn't even venture into this territory without talking with the team about what the specific ARARs are going to be. So her points here being, you know, pretty obvious. No differentiation between applicable, relevant, and appropriate, and to be considered. No basis for these determinations. So it sounds to me like people are just kind of throwing them out there without really knowing what they're doing with them. And then that's all she had. Wait, maybe make sure. Her comment about key information regarding data quality being buried in the appendices, which was a few slides back. Sorry about that. I missed this note. Examples include information regarding moving samples from one location to another, needing to resample observations of staining, odors, wells going dry during pumping, insufficient sample volume collected, obstructions encountered, et cetera. This information was often important in evaluating the data, yet it wasn't brought forward into the body of the report. It was just left in the field notes in the appendix or logs or whatever appendix that might be in. I've seen that as well. Okay, I'm going to not take questions on Debbie's. No, I'm kidding. I can take questions now, Duane, if you want me to on Debbie's.
Let's just proceed on with your material, and we'll see if there are any questions at the end.
At the end. Okay.
Yeah.
That's fine. Okay, that's Debbie's contact information. You could email her directly if you want. And then my part of the presentation is really just three slides. And I wanted to speak more from the design team leader or the project manager perspective about RIs, my experience on them thus far. I've had one significant site which required a entire revamping of the MRS footprints from what was in the site inspection report, the archive search report. And for those of you who work the FUDS program at all, you know that this is a cumbersome process we go through to go through realignment. It's a programmatic thing. And anyway, the explanation that I had to do was quite lengthy. The research aspect of, I cannot emphasize how much, how important it was to research the meaning of those footprints and not take them for granted. And maybe everybody already knows this by now because the CX has been pounding this in our heads for years, you know, but I just, I have a greater appreciation for it now. Once we see those lines on a piece of paper, it's very tempting to just say, ah, that's the MRS, I'm just going to go with it. I had an older ASR. They're limited in terms of what they were able to do at the time. Suffice it to say, the interviewer, was wrong. The main person, source of information they relied on in the ASR was not reliable. And we essentially had to rewrite history. And thankfully, the contractor found a very useful map that changed the whole footprint. But anyway, I just want to put in a plug for challenging those ASRs and those SIs in terms of your footprints, and changing those footprints is very doable at the early stages and on through. And you can revisit those footprints. We got rid of a lot of acreage at the beginning stage of our RI by just talking about the water acreages and whether it made sense to get rid of those acreages early on. And we got some agreements early on that in the SI phase they never did. So that was a success. Needs to be thoroughly explained. My next point is a little more challenging, I think. In the attempt to get agreement or cooperation from landowners, land managers who need certain accommodations, I think I just advise a lot of caution. Schedule can get really messed up by landowners or land managers who need very specific accommodations, and we all want to bend over backwards to please those who don't want us on their property. But I think we tend to make agreements that we don't necessarily have to. Perhaps it's tempting in a fixed-price, performance-based environment to let our contractors make those talk these things through together before we make agreements. I would also advise providing a good example of an RI report to our contractors. A lot of those comments that Debbie had could be, in my opinion, avoided on both work plans and RI reports if we can provide good examples that we feel good about. And their government property, I know, you know, we need to be careful about issuing drafts and draft finals. We have to wait for the final document. But the guidance documents do not provide templates, and these are difficult documents to put together. They're very time-consuming. They're very detailed. To the extent that we can help each other out, I think we should. And I guess I do want to just say the RI conclusions, I think, are particularly challenging. And I agree with Debbie that, you know, it's very tempting to just present the data, not really talk about what it means. And redrawing, in my view, footprint reduction is a, you know, particularly for FUDs, is a primary goal. You know, I know the general goal for an RI is to identify nature and extent of contamination, but I really challenge the group to think about, you know, as Bill Veith touched on, where are we taking this? And we really have to think about what the size of your MRS is, because everybody, again, sees those lines on a map, and that's where they see the contamination is. And at the end of the day, when you have your results, when you have your statistical analysis done, you're going to have some polygons drawn, theoretically, on a map that says this is where your problem is. And, yes, you have to think about what you're going to do with that, but how your report needs to very clearly describe what those new polygons are and how you got there. I found that to be a little more challenging than I thought it was going to be. And maybe one of the reasons was that I don't understand UXO Estimator well enough, but we didn't have a clear, my next slide kind of talks about this, and I didn't have a clear idea from the beginning that we were going to be using UXO Estimator to estimate both MEC and MD density. And when the CX reviewed the document that I'm referring to here, they challenged us on the use of UXO Estimator to estimate the density of MD, and we ended up having to change our approach to defining our problem area to say anywhere we find any MD, we have to define this as an MRS. We wanted to say, well, you know, it's kind of like subjective, and if we have maybe a certain amount of munitions debris, it's okay. We don't really have an indication of MEC unless it's at, say, I don't know, a density of 10, you know, and we very subjectively threw. Anyway, suffice it to say, you know, if you're going to use, I think it's appropriate if we're going to use UXO Estimator in this way, we're using this yes-no hypothesis, and we have to say either yes or no, if that makes any sense. You know, that the MD items are considered indicative of MEC, and we're going to use them to delineate the MRSs, which is a very conservative approach, mind you, and it does, you know, we are applying this at a site that has very little MEC. I mean, 7-8 items were found over 700-800 acres. It's a very old site, but still, it's, you know, it's a very conservative approach. And that's all I have. That's my information, and I can take questions.
Very good, Julie. We appreciate it. And again, I appreciate you stepping up and being willing to help out since Debbie was unavailable. You did fine. She'd be proud. So,
she doesn't know what I said about her.
That's right.
And I'm sorry I don't have any photographs, but if I did, it would be a picture of our building in the middle of downtown Baltimore and Debbie in her cubicle with documents piled all up around her. That's what I would have.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of what I can picture there.
It's kind of sad.
We had one question that came in, and this actually did tie into Debbie's portion of the presentation.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to take a pass on it, that's perfectly fine, but I'll throw it out there anyway. And it was, is it possible to expound on inappropriate use of VSP and UXO Estimator?
Let me see if I can remember our discussion. Well, you know, I don't remember. I have to say I'm not sure what Debbie was thinking of. We didn't talk about this one specifically, but I know she attended training and is pretty well schooled on VSP, and I'm assuming UXO Estimator too, and I can only guess that, you know, she's, you know, finding that people aren't really applying it, or are, you know, they're not using the correct inputs. You know, I'm not really sure, but I'd be happy to follow up with her if somebody wants to email me their question or talk about it.
Okay. Well, and that's fine. And we have Debbie's POC information there on the slides. And also, you know, I would mention I'm gonna go out on a limb a little bit and, you know, say that, you know, for VSP and UXO Estimator, there are some underlying assumptions that that go into the statistics for those particular tools, and if you violate those assumptions, then you're on very shaky ground, or you're potentially on shaky ground regarding the conclusions that you draw. So, you know, you have to understand and pay attention to those assumptions. And in addition to Debbie, I know that the MCX, Andy Schwartz at the MCX, he is definitely a guru when it comes to VSP and UXO Estimator. So if anybody has specific questions about those particular tools, I would encourage you to contact either of those. Here's another quick question. Julie, when you say that NEMD would be considered indicative of MEC, did you consider the type of MD?
In this case, it was scrap. I don't know, honestly. I can't remember without going back and looking. But you know, if it was something that we could rule out as being related to, I'm trying to think of an example. You know, if it was something we could clearly say was not MEC related, I don't know, if it was small arms, you know, debris or something like that, you know, clearly we would exclude it. We would try and exclude it from our from our conclusions and our delineation of the MRS. But these were pieces of scrap that we could not do that with. I mean, we could not clearly say this is not MEC related. I mean, they were, you know, I didn't see them. I haven't seen photos of them, but, you know, they were marked.
What I would proffer is that, you know, each project is unique. You know, the unique weapons, unique weapon systems, unique ranges, topography, land use, all of those things. And that kind of goes to the point of employing the ordnance and explosive safety specialists on the PET, because they're going to have a wealth of knowledge to be able to make
right.
those case-by-case determinations and tell
sure.
them the full and complete story in the characterization.
Yeah, I mean, it would really depend on what the item was, where you found it, you know, whether you could rule it out as potentially being indicative of mech or not. You know, this happened to be an old proving ground that, you know, there were probably there, you know, there's scrap from the ages there and probably scattered, you know, all over the place because it's in a very dynamic environment where the soil's conditions are changing. Things are moving all the time. So that was another reason, you know, we couldn't say, well, this doesn't have anything to do with, you know, with operations, you know. So I would encourage you to see if there's a way to rule it out or not.
Okay. Another quick question was, since you mentioned it, do you have an example of, do you have a good example of an RI report to use as guide?
Well, I think between all of them at this point, we could definitely come up with one in Baltimore. And, I mean, we've got stacks of them at this point, and I would definitely be willing to throw one out there. And preferably, you know, have another set of eyes look at it, maybe at the CX or something. I don't know. But let me get with Debbie when she gets back, and we'll pick a gem and take the title page off so we won't be showing favorites or any perceived favorites, because that's, you know, I don't want that perception to be out there, you know, that this is, you know, the model or anything. It would be purely, you know, we need to be sensitive around that. So we might have to do some redacting. I'm not really sure.
Right, yeah. I was going to say, tread carefully there.
Yes.
Okay, excellent. Very good. Well, currently, and again, thank you very much, Julie.
Sure.
And currently, I think those are the questions that have come in thus far for your segment of today's webinar. We're going to transition and move into the open Q&A and discussions session now. And we have several questions that have either come in after, you know, speakers finished their presentation, or we simply didn't have time to cover them during the presentation. So we'll try to get to those now. And I'm going to be going on memory and trying to throw these to the appropriate people and see if we can get this squared away. So I'm hoping that I can assign these to the right speaker. And we had several that came in and that were related to Kate Catlett's presentation. Kate, I'm gonna ask you to see if you can tackle several of these questions. The first one was, it seems like a lot of the quantification was based on educated assumptions on your particular case study. How repeatable is this method from site to site, where the experts might be different, where they may have a difference of opinion?
That is a great question, and that is something that we've talked about some internally. Our belief is that this type of expert elicitation can be very effective across multiple sites. So some of the factors such as the likelihood of somebody encountering a MEC item would be fairly applicable across different sites if we could develop a type of database or a kind of a standard use scenario like EPA has for regular contaminant, RCRA contaminants and such. We could take something like that and apply it to many other sites. And then you could go back on the expert elicitation and gather data to support it as well if there was a significant interest in that, or if there was data that was available. We could combine both the expert thoughts and expert knowledge with data that would help support the input to such a model.
Okay. Very good. Why did y'all elect to use analog data rather than digital data for this particular demonstration?
That's a good question. I think number one, and I might have to go back to somebody from Weston there to be sure if I remember, because this was over a year ago, and even though I'm fairly young, I still have memory issues. But I think that it was mostly just a time issue. The analog was, I think, a little bit faster to do on the trails, and we were mostly just interested in the surface. Since it was a recreational site, we weren't worried about getting too deep on there, and it might have also been a cost issue, so a combination of all three of those. Is my recollection.
Got it. Okay. Who's the Army contact for this project? Who was it that was managing the contract?
We worked primarily with the Montana Army National Guard, with Sundy West and Cliff Humans before Cliff retired. And then I believe it was through the National Guard Bureau. And I'd have to look up who at NGB we worked with.
Okay. Got it. So, yeah, it was National Guard contract, sounds like. Or
right.
They spearheaded it anyway. Okay.
Right. Yes.
You talked about the risk statements. And what was the ultimate risk statement that that was allowed by the Bayesian approach?
The ultimate risk statement, let me see if I am answering the right question here, but the ultimate risk question was, what is the likelihood of an incident happening? What's the likelihood of somebody detonating a MEC item, a member of the public in particular in this case? So we went through the whole process of what's the probability of MEC being there, what's the probability of somebody encountering it, and then what's the probability of once they encounter it, a detonation occurring.
Okay. Well, and so I guess those three components is kind of a segue into the next question. Those three components, is that what determined the probability of a MEC incident, occurring? Is that those three elements that fed into it somehow?
That's the main three elements. There's been a lot of literature review in the past. It's basically in alignment with what MECHA does as well. They look at the density of MEC and the likelihood of encounter and some detonation, although it's set up a little bit differently. But a lot of the previous methods that have been used to quantify MEC risk use those three main components, and then you can include all sorts of other components, like sub-factors that would go into those, which I'd be happy to go into more. But those would be the main three components, and then we have sub-factors that we could include and break down those main components into different factors.
Okay. Well, it's again, this is your opportunity, so I mean, it depends on how much detail you care to get into. But.
Sure. Okay, so let me think this through just a minute. I guess the probability of somebody encountering MEC could be broken down into different factors, like what's the probability of somebody being on the site, which, you know, is like it's typical risk assessment type of parameters. How many people are on this site walking or jogging per day, per year? How many hours of exposure would somebody have? What's the likelihood, once somebody's exposed, of picking up an item? You know, is it an attractive item? Those 40 millimeter rounds were, and so, you know, so these different factors could be broken down into different probability statements that would then feed into these main concepts of what's the probability of somebody encountering MEC. And so that's true for MEC density as well as the likelihood of an item detonating. But with this site and for this approach, we made it kind of as simple as we could, partly to demonstrate the concept, partly because of funding issues, which isn't that what a lot of it comes down to? How much funding do you have to do this? And so we made it simple, but it worked. And we were able to show a low density of MEC on the site, which agreed with our initial intuitive understanding.
Okay, great. And here's a question. I'm not sure that I may not be interpreting this question entirely correctly. I'm not sure I'm fully understanding it, but I'll give it a stab. What is a rough order magnitude of encountering risk drop-off between items on surface and subsurface in your case at Fort Missoula?
I'd have to go back and look at the model, and if somebody would like more information, please let me know. But I think we basically just looked at the surface, because in the areas that we were, there's no camping, there's no digging. People are walking and riding horses and that sort of thing, and mountain bikes. And so that type of activity, really the concern was mostly on the surface. I mean, we did the digital geophysics grids and did some subsurface investigation, but it was like, you know, all surface and zero subsurface in terms of our Bayesian model. But you could break it down into surface and subsurface. You could look at subsurface, what your estimate of MEC would be for subsurface density, and you could estimate how much for a site, not this Fort Missoula one, but for other sites, how likely is it for somebody to do an activity that would go subsurface, that would make subsurface MEC of a concern.
Okay. Got it. Very good. In one of your slides, you said that all MEC was probably found along trails, but it looks like, you know, based upon the map and the slides that you presented, most of the sampling was done along the trails. And so did that bias the results somewhat?
I suppose that's an interesting question. We, you know, the digital geophysics grid showed that there was MEC off the trails and in the open areas of the target areas for sure. There was munitions debris found a lot of places in that one main target areas where they had to do the TICRA, the time critical removal action. And so they Weston did that, and they had to clean up an area because we found some 40-millimeter rounds there that we decided were of concern, even though they were just, I believe they were just slightly off the trails. But we found them in the trails investigation. And so, yeah, I mean, if you're looking just on the trails and you say, well, that's where the munitions items are, that's a bias. But if people really don't go off the trails, which is, you know, posted on the signs, and you'd have to be maybe somebody out there observing people and their behavior. Do they really stay on the trails or not? In some areas, some recreation areas, they would stay on the trails. In some recreation areas, they probably are off the trail a lot, even though signs would say stay on the trails. So does that answer the question, Dwayne?
Yes, I believe that's a pretty good stab at it. I think so for now. Again, if you know, if people want more detail or want some clarification or think of follow-on questions, we do have the POC information posted. So please feel free to contact our speakers or one of us, you know, hosting the webinar, and we'll see if we can put you in contact with the right people. One last question here, Katie, for your presentation, and I think you can tell from the questions, your presentation definitely stimulated quite a bit of interest. So that's good. But the last question that came in relative to yours was for the MEC risk assessment, what level of explosive incident risk did y'all define as acceptable?
You know, I would honestly have to go look that up. And I would have to look it up from I think what we did was a relative risk, because the risk of something detonating, we took that as a relative statement. Like a lot of smiles and stuff about and laughter about, well, you know, would you spend $10 to go clean this up, or would you, when you do an expert elicitation, you put it in terms of money. But the outcome of our probability of an incident, given encounter, the probability of detonation was a relative ranking, so 100 times more likely or 1,000 times more likely for one round versus another round on the site. And so the risk at the end of the day that we estimated was a relative risk.
I see.
And so because we had kind of an idea of the number of digs that we wanted to do, we had an idea of the number of grids that we were going to investigate. And so it came down to, you know, what were the highest, and we picked a highest level out of what we had there. But you could use the same type of philosophy to come up with a number for a probability of detonation if you wanted to do that. And there was an attempt done in the past by Jackie McDonald, but we think she didn't quite go about it exactly the right way, because when you are talking to a bunch of experts, and we've talked to a lot of UXO folks, you know, you're out in the field, a lot of EOD guys and UXO techs who would maybe come up with different ideas of which rounds might be most sensitive, or which fuses might be most sensitive to detonation. But we think that if you put a bunch of folks in the room together, that there could be some sort of common ground found. And the key is, at least from our perspective, is to include uncertainty. Yeah, we're not, you know, we don't know everything. I don't know if we know anything in life, you know. Is there anything certain in life? But if we can include uncertainty, especially when we're talking about risk, if we're not just making conservative assumptions, if we can include uncertainty in our knowledge, we can do more realistic modeling, have more realistic decisions rather than conservative decisions about sites. And that means you include your uncertainty in the whole process. And that's what we think you can do all with MEC risk assessment. You can do that with your sampling design and how you set up your options for cleanup to the site is right. Including the uncertainty. And I don't want to force Bayesian modeling down your throat, but that's part of the beauty of this type of approach and a decision analysis approach is something that folks throughout this afternoon have talked about is what is it that we're trying to do? You know, look at and keep the end in mind when we're going out to collect the data. And that the DQO process walks through that, but we don't always use the DQO process to do that.
Right. No, that's excellent. Yeah, very interesting, very provocative. Good scope. Okay, well, Katie, again, I want to thank you for your efforts. It looks like that's the last question that I had on my list that had cropped up relative to your material. Jay, hopefully we still have you. We had a question that came in regarding your presentation, and that was, are there any studies in place or planned to help standardize the scaling of sampling units within specific types of ranges? You know, that could be potentially be used as a tool for PDTs during the planning process.
Right. I'm not aware of any specific studies. I had a proposal in with ESTCP last year to look at this issue, but unfortunately they were not interested in that. Who was that? Was it Weston? No, it was URS. They were doing some work at the Kastner Range down, I think it's in Yuma Proving Ground.
Kastner's out at Fort Bliss.
Fort Bliss. And they use some of the wide area assessment technologies. They use LIDAR, and they used HeliMag, and then ground-based geophysics to help define decision units. And they were going to use this extrapolation technique, but then they started when they started collecting the samples and analyzing them, they were having more detections than they anticipated. So then they went to Plan B, and I'm not sure exactly what Plan B ended up being. So unfortunately right now there really isn't a lot of information out there.
Okay. Very good. Well, I'll tell you what, I haven't seen any additional questions crop up here in the past several minutes. If you do have a question, you know, now is the time to submit it. Otherwise, we're going to segue into wrapping up this particular webinar. I believe the last headcount that I saw for today's attendance on the webinar was 218. Does that sound right, Jean?
That does.
Excellent. Very good. Well, with 218 people sitting in on our webinar today, that is quite excellent, and we are grateful for each and every one of you. And hopefully this was very beneficial. I thought there were some really great material, some great presentations provided today. I had a couple of last minute announcements that I wanted to make. One was a reminder for the next and final webinar for this particular year, for FY13. Again, we are planning to do a webinar series in FY14. We're in the planning stages for that, but there's only one more scheduled for this year, so please register for it if you haven't already done so, and let your colleagues know about it, get them registered. And then today's session, you know, it was recorded, so you can go back and listen in on it, or forward the information to someone if you think that they would benefit from it. And then the last thing that I wanted to mention again was, if you have an idea for a particular topic or someone who would be a great speaker, by all means, please let me know, and we will see if we can get them penciled in on an agenda for the FY14 webinar series. I don't know that I have anything else that comes to mind that I need to wrap up. I believe I've covered everything. I'm going to ask my co-moderator here, Nick. Is there anything that you wanted to bring out? And then if not, then I'm going to turn it over to Gene to close it for us.
Oh, you covered it. Just thanks again.
Very good. All right. Well, thank you all, and Gene, I'll let you close out this webinar for us.
Okay. Great. Well, thank you. I'm going to go ahead and pull up a couple of final reminders for those of you joining us today, including some information on how you can find the copies of presentation materials that were shown today, how you can supply feedback for today's session, and then for those of you that are interested in earning credit or CEUs or PDHs for our seminar series. We'll talk about that, and then we'll go ahead and close things out. All of the PowerPoint presentations are available from the seminar homepage. You'll see something called Links button or additional resources on the homepage. You can find the slides there. That same information and hyperlink is also available on the right side of your window under web links. You'll see something that says seminar resources. If you click that, press browse to, you can actually open up a page and download each of the individual presentations that were covered. If you do have any problems downloading them, please feel free to send me an email and we'll work to get that resolved and get you copies of the materials. If you're looking or interested, we would appreciate if you could take just a moment to fill out a short feedback form for today's session. I know that I and Duane are reading each and every single submission here, so we are continuously counting on your input to help improve these deliveries and sustain the seminar series and offer future ones. The feedback form is very short, and it'll take just a moment to fill out. Again, that's also hyperlinked on the seminar homepage. It's also under the web links on the far right side. So if you're watching the recorded version, you too can submit feedback for replaying the recorded version of the seminar. Just follow the links and fill out the feedback form. When you fill out the feedback form, if you're interested in earning credits or a training certificate or CEU, we don't necessarily issue those types of credits or certificates directly from the CLUIN website. However, many of our attendees are able to earn credit from their training officer or accrediting institution. If you save your registration email, you save a copy of the agenda, which again is available on the homepage, or you download copies of the presentation materials, and then you fill out the feedback form, there's a box you can check to ask for a confirmation email to be sent to you for your own records. That email will at least confirm you filled out feedback after the live delivery. So if you couple all of those resources together, it's very possible you'll be able to earn credit from your individual institution or training officer. If you need additional help, though, verifying your participation today, please feel free to reach out to me again. My contact information is found on the seminar homepage for today's session. We will have that recording available in approximately 1 to 2 weeks. You will automatically get an email as soon as that recording is available, and you can feel free to forward that on to a coworker or colleague that you think will find it valuable. As Duane said, we have another session coming up next month, so I hope to either see you